I'm James Simmons. This is Alternative Outlook. Welcome to Alternative Outlook. Other news sources read from a news feed in their skyscrapers. Alternative Outlook is on the ground, where people speak for themselves, producing an alternative narrative rarely heard in the mainstream media.
We also provide a platform for intellectuals who question the establishment while offering solutions ignored by those in power. Alternative Outlook is about building solidarity through illustrating the interconnectedness of struggles throughout the world and revealing a consistent, unifying struggle and theme, resisting the inherent exploitative nature and systematic shortcomings of capitalism.
I'm James Simmons. This is Alternative Outlook. Welcome to this week's episode of Alternative Outlook Radio. We continue our running segments on voices of the houseless in the United States this week with interviews from three single mothers that are houseless and their personal experiences. Tiffany Sykes, Kimberly Powell, and Tyra Harper were interviewed, and they are all from the Philadelphia area. We also have commentary from political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal titled The Transmogrification of Barack Obama. We have a story on the climate march in New York City. Will massive people's climate march launch a movement that can challenge corporate power? We also talk about the student walkout protests in Jefferson County, Colorado over the curriculum being taught. And we have a story on shadowy militant organizations that the Obama administration has invoked to help justify strikes and the expansion of military operations in Syria. This and more, all on this episode of Alternative Outlook Radio. But first, we will start with an interview of Tiffany Sykes, a single houseless mother from Philadelphia. Enjoy.
Hello, my name is Mercedes and I'm from ECS.
Hi, I'm Tina, T-I-N-A, last name Sykes, E as in David, Y-K-E-S. Desiree.
My name is Kato, K-R-E-V. I'm from St. Barnaby.
My name is Angel, A-N-G-E-L. I'm spotted E-S-P-A-D-A.
What led to your unfortunate circumstances?
We moved from Harrisburg, and I moved down here.
Why did you move?
Basically, my mom. My mom at the time, she was doing drugs, and she was telling me that she needed help, my help. So I came down here from Harrisburg, packed all my stuff, came down here. She told me that she had found me a house. I had saved all my money up. Came down here, it wasn't a fact. She was still doing drugs. We wound up staying at her house, and we was all sleeping on a twin pull-out bed. And she was still doing drugs, doing it in front of the kids. And then I was like, I have to go. I went to my uncle's house. I thought they would be up and up, not doing drugs, not none of that. Come to find out they were doing the same thing. So I left there. I went to Salvation Army. I asked them, what do I have to do to get into shelter? They told me I had to stay here, then I had to go to OSHA. The next morning I went, and then I went to a couple of other shelters before I actually came here. The other shelters, it wasn't for me. I couldn't really handle some of the stuff that was going on. It was filthy. It was rats running across their vents. It was just a whole bunch of other stuff going on that I knew I wasn't able to do. So after that, we left and went to another shelter. I went to Wayne Hall. It was a nonprofit shelter. I did the program there for, I think it was like 6 months. I was done with the program because I wasn't on drugs. I wasn't on no alcohol. So I didn't have any problems. It was just me out of housing. So I finished the program. I was still homeless. So I left, went to Atlanta, moved to Atlanta for a little bit. Atlanta, it was great. The housing down there was great for me. I had a nice job, everything. But I was still lacking. I was lacking my family. All my family's in Philadelphia. So then I picked the kids up, came back to Philadelphia. And this is where I'm at now. I went to OSHA. They moved me here.
How has ECS been? Do you enjoy them?
Yeah, for the most of it, yeah, they have. I really did. When I first got here, it was like, I can't do this. I can't. They got too many rules. I can't do nothing in here. The kids, I couldn't do nothing with the kids. But after, I think it was like my first or second month, I was like, oh my goodness, this is very nice for me. It's clean. It was a nice, clean building. I could actually lay my head down, not worried about if a roach gonna crawl in my kid's ear. Because other shelters I've been in is horrible. Compared to this shelter is like a castle, honestly. This shelter is very good with me and the kids. Even though I had my rust patches with them, I like it here.
So most of the shelters you've experienced have been
horrible. It was actually horrible for me, I would say. I don't know nobody else, but for me and my kids and the way we used to live in, it's horrible. There's roaches everywhere, and then when you say there's roaches, they be like, okay, y'all brought them here. That's not necessary everybody bring roaches here, because one thing I'm scared of is roaches. And it was just horrible. They didn't want to clean up behind themselves. They always wanted us to clean it. They didn't want to do anything. And then when you speak about it, they throw it back on the residents like it's all the residents' fault. It's not all our fault all the time. And when I came here, I was liking it because it was clean. It was very clean. We clean it, they clean it. It's just clean to me.
What was your childhood like?
My childhood, I won't say it was a perfect childhood. Before the drugs came, we had a perfect childhood. Like, I couldn't ask for nothing better. My mom, we lived in Bayard Street in Mount Airy. I went to McCluskey School for kindergarten through, I think it was like the second grade. It was great. And then my mom met my stepdad. And then they started doing drugs, and then she just like went downhill from there. My mom got us took in. We was living in a shelter, actually. My mom left, went back with my stepdad, doing drugs. She left me and three younger brothers and sisters with me and left us in a shelter. And they took us from the shelter. And from there, I actually spent like 7 or 8 years in foster homes. My younger three brothers, they went to Chambersburg to like a shelter together. And I was the only one left in Philadelphia by myself. So it wasn't great. But I could say it wasn't the best. It wasn't. But I'm not going to say that I'm going to blame like my childhood for me acting all crazy, because I can't. It was all right for me. I dealt with it like I'm dealing with it now.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear about that. It must have been very tough having to have your family separated.
It was tough. It really was tough, but it was tough for me. I did what I had to do. Because if I didn't do it, I wouldn't have nobody but me. So I had to do it. I had to be strong. I had to do everything I had to do to be strong for my little brothers and sisters. So basically, I just, hey, you move me, you move me. If you don't, you don't. It was hard. I went through a lot. But I can say I'm a better person. I can really say I'm a better person.
You need a minute?
No, I'm good.
Does anybody have a tissue or anything?
All right, Mommy?
Yeah, I'm okay.
There you go.
Thanks.
You're a very strong person. Very
yeah.
Strong. So these are your children?
Yeah. These are my pride and joys. I lived through them.
She made me to us too.
Huh?
So these are all yours and you have them all?
Yeah.
Children in foster care?
No, I kept them. I don't do drugs. I don't drink. I don't do none of the stuff that my mom did. I try to do stuff 10 times better than my mom. So without the drugs, without the drinking, the abuse from boyfriends, if I feel as though that I'm going to get into it with somebody, they got to go. Because I know I'm not going to put my kids through it like my mom put me through it. You just got to go pack your stuff and go out the front door the way you came in.
I'm glad that you're living such a righteous life, that you're not falling to prey to the same things your mother did. It's really great. What kind of support do you get from the government?
Right now, I get welfare right now. I get cash assistance and food stamps and medical assistance. That's all for right now.
How much is it a month, you say?
My cash is, I think it's like $589 a month. And the food stamps is like $702 a month.
And is it enough for the 5 years?
It's never enough for 5 of us because it's the 5 of us. We can't really live off of $589, but I make do with it. I could always, if I need something, I know I always have like cousins or friends that can help me to go through it. I have a lot of friends. If I would ever need anything, all thing I do is call one of them. I have a little sister that lives down here. If I need like daycare or money for some odd reason, if she have it, she give it to me. That's how we always been. It's all right. I think once I get settled into my housing, I'm in school right now. So once I get settled with my housing, I can go back to work and I can get paid what I usually get paid. I don't have to wait for welfare, but right now I'm gonna take it for now because right now it's helping me and the kids.
What are you going to school for?
I go to criminal justice. I go to University of Phoenix. No, you don't. Great. Sit down. Sit back.
What do you want to be?
Actually, a CSI, crime scene investigator.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you're just trying to get on your feet and have your own career and your own house and your own.
Yeah, I'm trying to do something with my life, like. I always did something with myself. I never been a person that sit home all day. I have a lot of skills. I worked as an EMT for 2.5 years. I worked as a CNA for 1.5 years. So I have a lot of skills. It's just, honestly, I like being home. I like being home with the kids. I like doing stuff with my kids. It don't be much to some people, but it's a lot to me because I just have fun with my kids. A lot of people are like, how can you sit home all day with your kids? You find something to do. You always find something to do. To me, I like being at home with them. Would you like being home with me?
I do.
You like being home with me? I know, Des.
So what was your prior employment before you had to come here?
I worked in Harrisburg at Life Team. It's on Cameron Street in Harrisburg, working as an EMT.
With ECS, is there any kind of pressure to become involved with any kind of religion?
Mm-mm.
No?
Mm-mm. It's never been like that here. Like, a lot of people think when, like, in different shelters, if you come in being, like, garbed up as a Muslim, they think a lot of shelters tell you cannot do that. But here in ECS, they don't care. If you're here for help, they'll help you. They don't care what race or religion you are. They just help you. You could come in here guarded up if you want to. They don't have a problem with it.
That's great. What do you think is the root of the problem of why there's homelessness in America?
I think it's like, for me, it was support system. Not having enough family support. Not having somebody there for you when you needed them. Not having a good upbringing, like having a good mom, like a mom that stays home, took care of you. Even though you got parents out here that's actually doing what they're supposed to do, you still got people that's homeless.
So you just really, you think that, overall, it's just really a matter of anybody. This could happen really to anyone.
Yeah, it could happen to you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's a matter of it's not that people are trying to abuse the system. It's that people.
It's just certain circumstance. Like you can go home right now. And y'all, I don't want your house to burn down, but your house can burn down. Boom, you're homeless. Not saying your family won't help you, but it's just like me. I can't. If my house burned down right now, I can't be like Aunt Stephanie. I need a place to go. She might say, yeah, come on in for like a week or so. But who to say she gonna let me stay there for 5 to 6 months? She's not old, Tina, no. Here comes the bull. You gotta buy this for her. You gotta buy this for her. You gotta do this. It's a whole bunch of things when it comes to being homeless. So it's like, hey, it happens.
And understand, most people have a support structure, so it's kind of, you know, people take something like that for granted because you look at someone, there are people out there like you who, you know, don't have the support structure that the vast majority of people have, then they take for granted. You know, something as simple as that can lead to really unfortunate circumstances. Is there anything that I've missed that you would like to add?
I don't know.
What about you guys? Has this been tough for you?
Okay. How's it been for you, Angel?
Not good.
I said Angel.
Same thing Mercedes said. Not good.
What has not been good?
Computer. Lab.
What else?
And when people always mess with me. It's a girl named Ajene. But she really messed with me because I don't even do nothing. Whenever I walk past, she be like, ew, Angel, ew. And I be like, ew, what? And then she just keeps rolling her eyes and rolling her eyes and keep telling her mom and her mom.
All right, how do your classmates think about you being in the shelter? What do your classmates think?
They keep telling everybody I live in a shelter. I live in a shelter. I can't afford nothing.
How to make it feel? How to make it feel?
Embarrassing. My kids laughing.
That's terrible.
How to make you feel, Boone?
I just ignore it.
You're a strong boy, huh? You just don't let it bother you?
Do you like it here?
It's good.
No.
Why don't you like it here? Sit up.
Matter, you like to have your own house to stay at?
All of a sudden, everybody get all tongue-tied. Nobody can't talk.
In our school, our school, when we was in our old house, our school used to be around a corner. That'd be easier. It takes us like 2 minutes to get to the school.
No, 18 hours.
Two.
Not 18 no, 10. Hours. 10. 18 hours.
How about you? Has it been tough for you?
Yeah.
What else?
And get to lay your head down somewhere and nice and comfortable and get to eat.
Yeah, think about that. Most people take that for granted. They don't realize how special that is. You just have some place to lay down and relax.
Some people, when we went downtown, it was a homeless man. He didn't have anything.
He didn't have anything to eat.
On newspaper. And he didn't eat nothing.
What did you think about that?
Now we're excited to bring you some Between the Lines interviews from last weekend's People's Climate March that drew over 400,000 to New York City.
They came by bus, train, air, and cars from across America and the world, and as predicted, the September 21st People's Climate March in New York City, which drew an estimated 400,000, was indeed the largest climate protest in world history. The protesters, who filled broad boulevards stretching from 94th to 34th Street on Manhattan's west side, was made up of a diverse crowd of all ages that included veterans of the 1960s civil rights movement, rank-and-file union members, students, and babies pushed by their parents in strollers. The march in New York City, which coincided with similar protests in dozens of other cities across the globe, was held just 2 days before world leaders gathered for an emergency United Nations summit meeting on climate change. The summit is intended to kickstart a process that it is hoped will result in a substantive international agreement at next December's global climate negotiations in Paris. The day after the giant climate march, thousands of protesters participated in a nonviolent civil disobedience action in New York City's financial district, where 100 people were arrested. The protest, dubbed Flood Wall Street, sought to bring attention and accountability to the role corporations and banks play in blocking government action to regulate climate change. Your reporter was at the climate march and spoke with former Ohio Congressman and presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich, as well as environmental activist and attorney Robert F. Kennedy Jr., about the obstacles preventing substantive action on climate change. We hear first from former Representative Kucinich.
This is an expression of a growing movement. And it's not just a movement for the environment, it's a movement for peace and connecting everything. Today is a powerful statement of human unity, that we're all one. We are interconnected and interdependent. And we're interdependent with the environment. This is our environment. This environment is with us, in us, and through us. We have to realize the collective responsibility that we have for protecting the future of the planet. And so I'm so proud to be with people from all over the world who are here today at this People's Climate March. And this is just the beginning. And there's a great sense of hope about this moment.
There are people who are going to be doing civil disobedience on Wall Street, believing that symbolic marches and legal protests don't go far enough, given the urgency of the situation.
Everything that's being done is important. Marches are important. If people wish to engage in civil disobedience, they have a right to do that. And if they're doing it for the right causes, that has to be respected, appreciated, and supported. Everybody must do something. That's the message. And so whatever one's doing, like today, all the people are marching today, they're visible. The main thing about a movement is visibility. People are personally putting themselves on the line and saying, this is who I am, I'm taking a stand, and you have hundreds of thousands of people in New York today are taking a stand for the world, for the environment. It is a powerful statement of human unity.
Just a question on economics. Naomi Klein just wrote this book, and a lot of people have been talking about this for many years, that our current economic system is incompatible with long-term survival.
Well, it's absolutely right. That's why we need to incentivize the development of new energy technologies. We can't even imagine how we can make the transition to a carbon-free and nuclear-free economy unless we begin to help fund those kinds of initiatives that will give us energy which is enough to sustain the planet. So I think that we're just at the beginning, and we cannot be locked into these old models of carbon-based energy. And so the transition is beginning. It's beginning everywhere. And today helps to give it a boost.
But the profit motive and constant growth, is that compatible with saving the planet?
Of course not. Of course not. What we need to do in the United States is to have campaign finance where there's public financing. Otherwise, Congress is just in an auction where offices go to the highest bidder. So I'm hopeful that'll change too. Today's a day of hope for the planet, hope in the future, confidence in each other, how collectively we can work to create a new world. And it starts today. It's great.
We hear next from environmental activist Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the son of former New York Senator and U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, and nephew of former U.S. President John F. Kennedy.
Politics in this country is driven by two forces. One of those is money, and the bad guys have all that on their side. The Koch brothers are putting $300 million of their own money into defeating the climate bill this year.
There are many people who think our political system is broken, as you just outlined. In many ways, it's not functioning well. There are people ready to do civil disobedience on Wall Street the day after this march, and I'm wondering if you think the time is right for more dramatic, more militant action to get the attention.
It is. I mean, I believe, and I've said this, and people have said that I'm being inflammatory when I say this, but I think the Koch brothers ought to be in jail. They ought to be getting three hots and a cot in The Hague with the war criminals, you know. And people say, well, that's inflammatory. Well, I was a district attorney in Manhattan, and we were putting kids, teenagers, in jail for a year for jumping a subway and saving 75 cents. These are people that are sickening millions of people. They're destroying our economy. They're costing our nation and, you know, $4 trillion in oil wars and these train bombs and all of this. They're killing people. And, you know, this is a moral issue. It's an economic issue. They're destroying our economy. They're subverting our democracy. They're compromising our national security. And they're they're poisoning us.
That was environmental activist and attorney Robert F. Kennedy Jr., preceded by former Ohio congressman and presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich, both interviewed at New York City's People's Climate March on September 21st.
Thanks to Between the Lines for bringing us those interviews from the Climate March last weekend.
I came in like a wrecking ball. I never hit so hard in love. All I wanna do is break your walls, but all you ever did was wreck me.
Two schools are closed today in Jefferson County as a large number of teachers called in absent. This follows the large student walkouts that we saw last week. Much of the media attention on the student protests have focused on the history curriculum and the proposed community review board. One of the majority Conservative members of the school board had said that instructional material in history courses should promote positive aspects of US history and avoid encouraging civil disorder, social strife, or disregard of the law. This has angered many teachers and students who say it's revising and sanitizing history. Bethany Cupp is a senior in the International Baccalaureate program in Stanley Lake High School. She told KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers that most of the students are protesting the possible changes to the history course, but many are also standing in solidarity with the teachers who have been protesting an evaluation-based system for awarding raises.
I feel like most people are protesting for the curriculum review committee because that is what most people know about. Not everyone has been paying attention as long as the students of Stanley Lake, so they don't know the problems with, you know, the compensation plan and other forms that they've just really disrespected teachers and students and community members. So I feel like most people are upset about the community review board, but a lot of people are also upset about other decisions they've made. And I feel that once the community review board is either passed or not, we'll still be able to get a lot of the community on our side about other decisions. And the teachers union has not in any way influenced students' opinions, nor have the teachers. Students have been influenced by students alone. This is, we've done our research all by ourselves, and the teachers have not said, hey, go protest. They just simply did their own protest, and we did too.
Kerry Dahlman is the president of the Colorado Education Association, a teachers union. She herself has been a high school teacher in Jefferson County. She told KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers that a lot of attention has been paid to the comments made by Julie Williams, the school board member, about the history curriculum. But Dahlman says that students and parents should also be concerned about other courses as well.
You know, Julie Williams cited AP U.S. history, and that's certainly what's gotten the most media attention. But she's also bringing in and brought up through that resolution other curriculum, sex education, growing and learning curriculum. Those obviously are concerns to educators and to the community at large, and particularly to parents. And when Julie Williams is talking about putting folks on a committee who have no expertise in the subject area and allowing them to make recommendations to the school board, you can't help but see how politicized that could be. And that's not what a quality education should be about.
With some of the states you mentioned that we're seeing this trend in as well, could you restate that for me?
So I think your listeners should definitely pay attention to what's going on in Tennessee, in Williams County, and all across the state of Texas. Certainly, you know, Texas as a state has backed away from some curriculum decisions and textbooks, etc., and published their own. We should all be very concerned about this growing movement. And I think, you know, for a long time, parents have been very trusting that the people who have run their school boards were listening to the educators in the classroom about what they needed in order to deliver that quality education. And we're seeing this trend of individuals elected to school boards backed by big money that frankly don't have the best interests of our students in mind.
Where do you think students students, parents, involved citizens should go from here? What are the next steps, or what would you be suggested next steps from this point forward?
Well, I would call on the community to specifically ask the school board to keep politics out of our schools, and to start listening to communicators. Start listening to the community and start collaborating once again with teachers and other education professionals in the district. That's not happening. There's a school board meeting next week. Show up for that. On October 3rd, there's another Boots on the Boulevard. We encourage you to join community members, students, and teachers all along Wadsworth Boulevard. And let's raise community awareness. Let's start a community conversation. I don't believe this is what Jeffco wants for its public school system. And it has become a national embarrassment, one created by the school board majority.
And we'll continue to follow what's happening in Jefferson County.
Okay, now.
And now we go to an interview from houseless single mother Kimberly Powell, an Alternative Outlook exclusive.
What led to your unfortunate circumstances?
My fortunate is very different. I relocated here from Trenton. Wanted to start life anew. I have a daughter that attends Girard College. She's a fourth grader. She's 10. I have a 20-year-old, soon to be 20, and she's graduating from college. And I have a 17-year-old who attends the Hershey School. So my circumstance was just a little bit different compared to the other ladies. I moved here to start life anew, and I was trying to find a job. I did find one, was working, but it was temp. But basically, when that ran out, couldn't find anything else. I got evicted, and I ended up going into a homeless shelter. My first shelter was called Axe, which is over by Temple University. And apparently, they had phased out, and they moved the women from Axe to Jane Addams, which is at 43rd and Chestnut. Basically, I was in the shelter for almost like a year and a half, going on 2 years. So that's where I ended up at, you know, for the time being. And
I'm sorry to hear that. What was your childhood like?
It was okay. It wasn't always the greatest, but it was all right. Coming from a family of 14 brothers and sisters, I'm the baby girl. My parents owned a store, a grocery store, so basically they didn't want me in the store because as I was growing up, my mother felt that I should like best go and live with my aunt and my uncle, which was her sister and her brother-in-law. So I basically was raised by my aunt and uncle. My aunt was very stern. She had a son, but he passed on. So I was like her first girl she raised. So she was very strict and very tough on me. There was not much I can really do except go to work and go to church. And that was it. You know, I didn't really get out much because I wasn't allowed to. I attended Catholic school all the way up to ninth grade, up to ninth. And then after that, I went to public high school for 10th and 11th, 12th. So that was basically kind of like a culture shock for me, going from 15 kids in a class to like 23 in a class. So I had good moments, I had its bad moments.
Why did you have to go live with your aunt and uncle?
Well, my parents didn't want me around in the store, like I said. So, because being I was the youngest, I was the baby girl. And at the time it was on the grocery store, you know, you have older people come in there. And as I'm getting older, you tend to start developing. And my parents wasn't having that. So I went and stayed with my aunt and uncle.
Have you received any kind of support from the government?
I did at the time. I was receiving welfare. when I had started working. I got off of that, received food stamps and their Medicaid for I and my daughter.
Was it enough?
No, it's never enough. It's never enough. Being that I just had my youngest one with me, I was getting $158 every 2 weeks. Food stamps, it varies. At the present moment, I'm getting presently at now like $238 for the month.
So, what do you think the government could do to make the program a little more efficient?
Basically, I feel as though if it's there, if you really need it. I mean, that's my belief. You know, you got to do what you got to do anyway. Do I tend to be on that? Technically, no, especially with food stamp. But in today's economy, as you know, jobless rates are going up. Food is very expensive, and it's going up, and it's hard to really, you know, afford food and put food on the table.
Do you think that maybe spending less money in certain areas and putting more money into areas like this would be a better idea?
Yes, I do, 100%. I really do. And they really need to try to look at that.
Are you a recovering addict or alcoholic?
No, never on drugs, never alcoholic, never smoke.
What was your employment before this?
My employment before was a paralegal. I graduated from college last year, so I have an associate degree in paralegal. I was working up until March when I was recently laid off. I freelance from time to time. I keep in contact with some, you know, attorneys, and if they need help, they'll call me to basically either go to court for them, do research. So it's okay. It's not enough, but you know, it pays a bill here and there for me.
How has ECS been for you?
I wasn't in ECS. I basically stayed at the Jane Addams Shelter, which was at 25 South 43rd Street. There, it was tough. It was really tough.
How did you find out about the shelter?
I found out for Jane Addams, basically when I was at Axe. That was another shelter. We was housed in the John Watermaker. It was actually a school over by Temple University. But Temple eventually brought the school because they wanted to tear it down to make it, I think, a high rise or a parking lot.
Do they have a religious affiliation of any type?
No, not that I can think of, not that I know of, because it was all different types of religions that came there. There were two girls on my floor that was Muslim, and it was another girl that was Catholic on my floor. So
I guess this is a kind of issue that doesn't have boundaries. It affects everyone.
Yeah.
What do you think is the primary root of homelessness in America? What do you think is the reason why we have this problem?
Unemployment. I think the unemployment, you know, people not making enough money to do what they have to do, pay their mortgage, car note, rent, whatever the case may be.
What do you think would help? Do you have any kind of suggestions or ideas that you would think would help make the problem? Alleviate the problem?
Well, no, not really, but my opinion, nowadays, it's hard to get a job anywhere without an education. So the more you try to do with your education, 1 minute, okay, it was at one point, you can have a high school diploma. Nowadays, you need like almost a PhD to just get a decent job. And without that, you really don't have anything. You know, they trying to enforce, you know, a lot of people to go back to school, which, you know, you do have a lot of people going back. Now you have, they making it easy where you can go online instead of sitting in a classroom. But people who have been on their jobs or was lucky enough to be at a job and didn't have to have a GED. I have an aunt that I live with who has a high school diploma, and that's all she has, and she makes good money. She does where they put computer chips. They make computer chips for NASA. And I mean, to get at her job now, you got to have like almost a PhD to get into her company. But years ago, you didn't need that. So it's kind of hard to say, at this present moment, because some people just luck up, you know, getting a good job and don't really have to worry.
What issues do you think that are ignored that make this problem more difficult, if any?
Compared to for homelessness people, mm-hmm. they don't. I just think the government don't really listen to people who are homeless or who have been homeless. I don't think they are taking it serious, because to them, I feel as though they feel as though it's not a issue at this present moment. Right now is either the banks, the auto ships, the auto dealers, the you know, the jobless. But until you can, like, really, you know, wake the government or the Congress up, you know, protest or march down there, they're not going to really take it as serious as, you know.
Well, what do you think of the fact that the government is so quick to give billions upon billions of dollars to banks and to auto industry, and yet would most likely probably never even consider giving it to people?
That's a good question. That I'm not too sure. Wow. I really need to wake up and listen to the little people on that. With the banks, to me, if you look at it, banks are always turning over different names. You know, one minute you got Wachovia, next minute they go to Wells Fargo's. Automaker industry, I mean, they're, you know, putting their business, their advertising out there, whereas now you can, if you can get a car, but if you lose your job, you know, they'll pay it for like a year, whereas before, you never had that. You know, just to keep these industries in business, people out here who is just, you know, living on the streets, some of them do want help, some of them may not want the help, you know, that's another issue that you have to look at.
Is there anything you would like to add that you felt I've missed?
No, it's just keep doing what you're doing.
All right, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn right now to Murtaza Hussein, reporter at The Intercept, who, together with Glenn Greenwald, wrote the piece, The Khorasan Group, Anatomy of a Fake Terror Threat to Justify Bombing Syria. Murtaza, welcome to Democracy Now! Murtaza is joining us from Toronto. Can you talk about what you've learned about the so-called Khorasan Group?
So the Khorasan Group is a group which first came up in the media around September 13th, roughly a week or so before the U.S. bombing campaign of Syria began. Heretofore, no one had heard of this group. It was not known in intelligence circles or among people who follow Syria. And suddenly we saw in the media that this was being described as a major terrorist threat emanating from that country and a direct threat to the U.S. homeland, unlike ISIS. So this ended up being one of the main justifications for the war in Syria, or the military airstrikes which are conducted in Syria. And it became the major media narrative justifying that action.
And talk about, well, for example, where the Khorasan Group got its name.
So the Khorasan Group, the name itself does not denote any group within Syria that anyone has familiar with or has heard of before. It's a name that was developed within the U.S. government to describe a certain set of groups, individuals within the group Jabhat al-Nusra, which is one of the opposition factions fighting the Syrian government. Jabhat al-Nusra is also believed to be a franchise of al-Qaeda within Syria, but unlike al-Qaeda proper, it's focused exclusively on fighting the government of Bashar Assad. So in order to justify these strikes against this group, the U.S. had to create a new name to designate these few individuals within that group that they're looking to target. So they developed this name, the Khorasan Group, which identified several fighters who they say planned to wage attacks against the United States as opposed to the government of Bashar Assad, and they conducted the strikes under that justification. Now, within Syria, people view this group as being indistinguishable from the regular group of Jabhat al-Nusra, and it's being viewed as an attack on that group, which is why yesterday you saw a statement from that group's leader vowing revenge for the deaths of his commanders.
I want to turn to CNN's Pentagon reporter Barbara Starr talking about the Khorasan Group.
Now, what we are hearing from a senior U.S. official is the reason they struck Khorasan right now is they had intelligence that the group of al-Qaeda veterans was in the stages of planning an attack against the U.S. homeland and or an attack against a target in Europe. And the information indicated that Khorasan was well on its way, perhaps in the final stages of planning that attack.
That was Barbara Starr of CNN. Your response?
So in the days leading up to the attack, several anonymous sources suggested that an attack was imminent. They suggested that there were a threat against airliners using toothpaste bombs or flammable clothing. And they said that, like Barbara Starr mentioned, they're in the final stages of planning this attack. After the strikes were carried out, several U.S. officials started walking back that estimation quite far and saying that the definition of imminence is unclear. And when we're saying, is a strike about to happen? We're not sure what that means exactly. So, in retrospect, this definition of a strike being imminent and this characterization of a threat coming from this group, which is very definable and very clear, became very unclear after the strikes. And they suggested through the New York Times the strikes were merely aspirational and there was no actual plot today existing against the United States. So, the actual justification for the strikes was completely negated after the strikes ended, which was something quite troubling.
Well, explain what you mean, negated right after the strikes began, right after the justification worked.
Right. So after the strikes happened and there were statements saying that people were killed and the group had been scattered, James Comey and many others within the U.S. establishment started saying that, well, you know, we said the strikes were imminent from this group, but what does imminence really mean? Could be 6 months, could be a year. And other anonymous officials started saying there was not any threat at all. There was not any plan in the works to attack the United States. And then further it came to light that the Khorasan group itself, which we'd been hearing about in the media, was a new enemy and was a definable threat against the United States, did not really exist per se. It was simply a group of people whom the U.S. designated within a Syrian opposition faction as being ready to be struck. So the entire narrative that developed and within the media developed was completely put to a lie after the strikes. And it was interesting that Ken Delanian reported the story first in Associated Press, saying that this was a new threat and a new group. And he was one of the first people to break the story afterwards, saying that U.S. officials are now adding more nuance, is the word he used, to their previous warnings about the group. So it was kind of a really egregious case of media spin, whereby the media had taken up this narrative of a threat from a new terrorist group, and then after the strikes had been conducted, which justified this group, they immediately took the opposite tack, saying that, in fact, there was no threat that was imminent, and the group itself did not exist per se. So it was really quite a failure of the media, which you've seen several times in the past as well.
You mentioned Ken Delanian of AP. Now, Intercept just put out another story. The CIA's mop-up man, LA Times reporter, cleared stories with agency before publication. Ken Silverstein writes, a prominent national security reporter for the Los Angeles Times routinely submitted drafts and detailed summaries of his stories to CIA press handlers prior to publication, according to documents obtained by The Intercept. He goes on to say, email exchanges between CIA public affairs officers and Ken Delanian, now an Associated Press intelligence reporter who previously covered the CIA for the Times, show that Delanian enjoyed a closely collaborative relationship with the agency, explicitly promising positive news coverage and sometimes sending the press office entire story drafts for review prior to publication. In at least one instance, the CIA's reaction appears to have led to significant changes in the story that was eventually published in the Los Angeles Times. Your response to that piece?
Right. So essentially, the administration will seek out reporters who are pliant and willing to work with them to leak stories like this. So in the sense of those CIA stories, this reporter had his stories vetted. He promised favorable coverage in exchange for access. And again, here, the Khorasan Group story first came out with this reporter. And, you know, the media's role is to ask questions and to vet these claims quite thoroughly. But instead, the claims were put out through reporters who were known to give favorable coverage and who were known to you know, take the administration's line in exchange for access. And it seems like this happened again in the sense that here was a reporter who put out the story. They did not vet who the Khorasan group is, what the veracity of these claims are, but they put it out in the media and it became a media story on its own. So I think that you're seeing the same narrative replay as happened, as we detailed in the previous story as well.
I wanted to turn to another piece that you wrote, Murtaza, Why the Islamic State is Not Really Islamic, which refers to a letter that has been signed by many Muslims. Can you explain who has written this letter and who it was sent to?
So there was an open letter published to the leader of the Islamic State, Abu Bakr Baghdadi, from over 120 of the most prominent religious scholars among Muslim scholars in the world. And there was a Mufti of Egypt, Bosnia, Nigeria, and many other countries around the world, including the United States. And they published an open letter condemning point by point the practices of the so-called Islamic State. And it was done purely from a theological standpoint. And they had given very rigorous critique of the group and found it, by their standards, to be un-Islamic. Now, this goes back to the question of what is or is not Islamic. Islam is not a monolith. It's subject to interpretations of the people who take part in it. And, you know, this group found them to be decidedly un-Islamic. I think most Muslims around the world would find them to be un-Islamic, despite their pretensions to the contrary. So, the point I was making in the article is that when you identify them as being Islamic and you say that they are the definition of Islam, you're playing to their narrative. That's the legitimacy they want, and which today they don't have, and they're rejected broadly by Muslims around the world. So it's important to say that, well, you know, they may partake in Islamic dialogue and they may use the symbols of Islam. We cannot let any one group of extremists anywhere define a faith or a civilization which is a home, you know, identified with by over a billion people around the world.
Well, we'll link to your pieces at democracynow.org. I want to thank you for being with us. We've been talking to Murtaza Hussain, who is a reporter with The Intercept. His latest two pieces, The Khorasan Group, Anatomy of a Fake Terror Threat to Justify Bombing Syria, and Why the Islamic State is Not Really Islamic.
The transformation of my lines, the transmigration of the mind. See what's in mind, a sea full of rhymes.
Now for a Mumia Abu-Jamal commentary.
The transmogrification of Barack Hussein Obama. When Barack Hussein Obama was first elected U.S. president, a sense of mad elation swept through areas that were once regarded as third world. Africa, because of his blood ties, and the Middle East, because of the faith tradition of his father. For them, Obama's elevation to the highest office in the land seemed to signify a change of epic proportions, for both regions are places where one's tribe, clan, and ancestry are powerful markers of identity. When Obama gave his speech in Cairo, his honeyed words sent excitement throughout Arab and Muslim communities and societies. The sense of change was palpable, but power elites don't support change unless it's to their advantage. Economic and political forces, at first shocked by his ascension, learned to fight long battles against him to assert their primacy in foreign affairs. Cronies of the Bush regime were absorbed back onto corporate boards and into think tanks, from which they launched word wars against Obama's patriotism, his faith, his competency, and his very honesty. He was a wimp, they said. He's soft, they said. And along came ISIS, formerly known as Al-Qaeda, in the Arab Peninsula. They provided the lure that proved utterly irresistible, terrorism. And suddenly, to the delight of the military-industrial complex, a new war is born, an air war, in two countries yet, and we are back. That old imperial itch, the urge to rule others, to determine the leaders of other countries, must be scratched. After 6 years, the Obama administration sounds like a brighter replay of those boorish bushes. War again. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
We're now going to segue to an interview from single houseless mother Tyra Harper, which was conducted in the Philadelphia area. This is once again an Alternative Outlook Radio exclusive, so enjoy.
Okay, Tyra, what led to your unfortunate circumstances?
I was living with someone else and something happened, so one day I decided to come into the shelter with me and my five children. Basically, I was living with their dad. And he left me and the kids in the house. And I went down to OSHA. OSHA placed me in ECS. And basically, I've been here for 2 years and 9 months.
I mean, if you don't mind, what was it that happened that made you leave?
What made me leave?
Yeah.
Where I was living?
Mm-hmm.
He left me for another female.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
What was your childhood like?
My childhood? Basically, I raised myself since I was 16 on my own. I have a mother and a father, but my grandmother raised me. And when she passed away when I was 16, I moved in with my kid's father. That's when we was together at least, I'd say, 10 years. So he decided to go with someone else. So that's when he left me and the children in the house, and that's when I came here.
Are you close with anyone in your family?
Basically, no. Uh-huh. My children, that's it. They've mm-hmm. been there for me. I actually did what I had to do for my kids. You know what I'm saying? I don't have nobody but me.
How many children do you have?
Five.
Five?
Mm-hmm.
Are they all with you now?
It's three that's with me, but my two boys that was staying here, they was going through some situations and behavior problems, and so I decided for them to go with their dad until I got into my house. But now, since I got into my house, they coming back with me.
Do you get any kind of support from the government, state or
yes.
federal?
Yes, I get welfare.
Is mm-hmm. that, if you don't mind me asking, what does that come out to?
I get $232 every 2 weeks, and in the food stamps I get $542.
Is that enough?
Nope.
Is it even close?
Nope.
No.
Especially for not the things that I want, that I need for me and my children. But you can make it something.
What kind of sacrifices does that usually entail? Having not enough money?
I mean, since I moved, well, when I came in here, I wasn't used to paying any bills. I wasn't used to following nobody's rules. Basically, when I was living with their dad, I had anything that I wanted. You know what I'm saying? Since I was 16, I was grown, doing what I had to do for, you know, to get what I had to get. But when I moved with their dad, he just gave me the world. And that was like when I was 17. He gave me the world. It was nothing that I ever wanted. You know what I'm saying? I had more love and coats than people that worked. You know what I'm saying? He gave me the world. Basically, I didn't know anything when I came in here. I didn't know how to pay no bills. I didn't know how to pay no rent. I didn't know how to do anything when I came in here.
That must have been very hard.
Yeah, basically.
Are you a recovering addict or alcoholic?
No.
No?
Mm-mm.
Just an unfortunate circumstance, huh?
Yep.
What was your prior employment?
I used to work in a shelter for men when I was living with my grandmother at that time. I was cooking their meals. It was for like 200 men. Like here, it was like 200 men, homeless men, or men that's coming out of jail or, you know, basic stuff like that. I did.
What's your typical day like, having to take five children by yourself?
It was four at that time when they dad left me. I mean, it hurt it because that was the person I've been with ever since I was 17. Basically, it broke my heart when I was living with my grandma. I was depressed. I was stressed. Then when I had jumped out into the light, I mean, into the world, I went out with somebody else, and then that's when I got pregnant with my son, Musa. That's my heart. He don't have no dad. I take care of him. I took care of him ever since he came to my stomach. He went through some problems. I did that on my own, dealing with him, but now he's two, doing good. Five kids, it's hard. It's hard in here, I can say. But I did what I had to do, because, you know, you gotta do what you gotta do.
Have you tried to get any kind of support from any of the fathers?
The one, the father that I have four by, he paid child support, yeah. The one they have my boys, but it's, I don't know, I think he's getting, he have my boys just for the money. But now, since I have my house, whatever, he's giving me a hard time to get my boys back. I have to go to court and all that, whatever, now, but I'm gonna do what I have to do to get all my kids back into my house. She with me, my oldest daughter with me, and my son Moose is with me.
How do you like it there?
My new house?
Yeah.
Shoo, love it. Before I moved into the house, I had everything you needed for a house before I moved into it. I mean, ECS helped me with what I had to do, plus my money that I would save. I went out and bought everything, basically TVs, bathroom for our rooms. We moved in there and it was furnished. So
ECS was a lot of help?
ECS? Oh my God, I love this place.
But that, do you know what you would have done if you didn't have somebody like ECS?
Shoo! I believe I'd be on drugs.
Wouldn't be able to handle it.
Nope.
Yeah, I don't blame you at all. How did you find out about the shelter?
By OSHA.
From OSHA?
OSHA was going to send me somewhere. I don't know. I remember the shelter where they was going to send me, but I was pregnant with Moose at that time, and I had to go to the hospital, so they sent me back to OSHA once I came to the hospital, and that's when they said ECS. And I was like, cool. I cried the whole day I came in here. But like 2 days after, I talked to Miss Vicky, Miss Shirley, Miss Jacoby, Miss Jackie, Miss Patnam. Then I got to know Miss Kara Hudson. And I just, man, it's like they family. They my family.
What is your job currently?
I'm still on welfare, but I'm going to school for my GED right now. I'm gonna do that next week, my GED. Then I'm going to school for culinary arts.
And the ECS is helping you with
mm-hmm.
that?
Mm-hmm.
That's great. What do you think is a major problem with why homelessness in America is such a problem? What do you think the major root of that is?
Well, if you're not paying your money in here, you gotta go. If you're not doing what you're supposed to do, you gotta go. If you stay out, you gotta go. They made it hard for us.
If you had to say one thing that homeless people are really looking for, what do you think it is, aside from the obvious?
I'm looking for it now. I'm gonna do what I gotta do, get into my permanent, pay my rent, and I'm gonna go to buying a home, really.
So you're not just looking to feed off of Uncle Sam. You're trying to get on your feet.
I'm trying to do what I gotta do. That's right. Yeah.
That concludes this episode of Alternative Outlook. I hope you enjoyed the program. And don't forget to visit us at alternativeoutlook.org. And remember that the revolution begins in the mind of a child.